Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with a remarkable person. Mark Palmer is a Renaissance man. The variety of things that drew, compelled, interested Mark are amazing. And his ability to go from one thing to another, his hunger for learning, his natural talent in so many areas, the through line seeming to be his desire and ability to be in charge, to make things happen. But in addition to that quality, there is his pursuance of excellence, his incredibly high standard for everything that he became interested in and took on, all of which seems so diverse, and yet he pulls it all together. It's a fascinating story. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person you think you're supposed to be, not the person other people think you should be, not the person other people are, but the person you really are. In my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And my interviewee today, Mark Palmer, is the poster child for The Lynn Show. He has many interests, many skills, many natural talents, and he pursued them even when they don't seem to go together, when other people might question them, when they don't seem to make sense. Mark, with an unerring ability to recognize what is his, what captures him, has put together a variety of different skills to create a very specific career. So here is Mark Palmer. Okay, so I'm here with Mark Palmer, and Mark is the owner of Mars Vision Productions. And I'm explaining to Mark that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I'm assuming that the art to which... Well, actually, I don't know what to call the art you...
Well, I mean, movie making, filmmaking.
So it's film, video, all that stuff,
yes.
Right? Okay, good. All right, I only ask one question.
Oh, okay.
And it is, do you remember, can you tell me, the very first moment that you were interested in, drawn to film, stories, any of that?
That's a good question. I don't know if it was any one moment, per se. It was more of a discovery process.
Tell me.
You know, I think when I was in high school, I was in theater.
Oh. So what drew you to theater? Do you remember that?
You know, it was an elective. I had to take a class.
So, are you serious?
So I took a class, and then I kind of like, I liked the building of the sets and the creativity of that.
Okay, wait, hold on. So are you saying until high school, you weren't drawn to anything? You were just sort of putting one...
I actually have two mindsets that is kind of interesting with me because... So in high school, I was in ROTC and I also was in theater. So I enjoyed the command structure and you know, I was battalion commander and rifle team captain. I enjoyed the structure and directing and telling people what to do.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm going to stop you here to say that I've seen you direct. So that hasn't gone away. Yes, you do. Yeah, it's quite clear that you're in command.
And then there was theater. And so...
Yeah, well, wait. I still haven't got it. So in the ROTC, you were a senior or something, right?
No. Well, so my brother was in ROTC, and he wanted to go, and this is in the late 80s, he wanted to go fly fighter planes. And so when I went to high school, he was on the rifle team. And I was like, my brother's there, I might as well try out. And I tried out, it was pretty decent. And
okay, but so far, I have heard nothing that suggests that you were thinking about your future or what you would do or what you liked or any of that. You were just putting one foot in front of the other. You were just a kid. You were doing whatever came up.
Yeah.
And one of the things that came up was this... I don't know what, the opportunity to do things related to army, to structure, to command, to that stuff, right? And then you took an elective in theater? Do you remember why you did that?
I had to take some kind of art thing. I think it was because it was girls, a lot of girls in theater.
Probably exactly right.
So, you know, in high school, you know, everybody likes girls, you know?
Yeah.
So, and then when I took theater And then it was just, I naturally gravitated to building stuff.
Sets, props.
So props. And so it's kind of like the teacher, and I would just be, okay, we need a bench, or we need some walls.
More command.
Yeah.
Right? You took.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of there. And, you know, I still remember not paying attention to a power tool and running my finger in a belt sander. Because I was flirting with girls, and that was not good. So from that point on, I realized you should pay attention
to the equipment.
And then, so I was in theater, and then I liked doing the tech at the back and doing the lights. I remember running sound for a couple shows and doing.
Okay, but you were never interested in acting yourself.
No, I really wasn't. I mean, I did act a few. I had a monologue, and I had to do a couple acting things, but it wasn't something that. I think I was always more concerned about the image, like what's out there, what you're trying to project.
Yes.
I think that kind of morphed into film,
Well, that brings up the question, did you see a lot of films? Did you watch a lot of TV?
This is really fascinating. It's odd. I've never really been this introspective before. I mean... I would go to ROTC in one period, then I go to theater the other period, and I enjoyed theater. I enjoyed the lights, the creativity, the stuff that happened there, but I enjoyed the structure, the command, and the precision it takes to shoot a rifle. I was back and forth in two different camps.
But in a way, they're not that different. They complement each other in an interesting way. That's how it seems to me. I mean, truly, if you say to somebody, here's this guy in ROTC and here's this guy in theater, they would say, really? That doesn't go together.
Yeah,
but the way you saw theater was very much about precision, about creating whatever it was that was going to happen, you know. And really, that's it's kind of what the, you know, the military is about. You're creating whatever you're going to do, right? I mean,
yeah, well, you're moving forward and affecting a situation. You want it to be done right. And then, you know, so I did that in high school, and it was time to...
Wait, I'm so curious. Really, I'm so curious about this. So, at this point, are you thinking, I want to go into the military? Well, you pretty much have to if you're an ROTC. Or were you thinking, well, maybe there's a thing for me in theater. Were you thinking any of that?
You know, I started to dabble in cameras a little bit with my video, with speech class. I think we had... High school speech. We had to do a project with a video camera. And I told a story about... forgot the acronym, but basically it was people with spinal cord injuries that could ride the back of horses, and that helped them out. And so I told this beautiful story, and it was really good. I partnered up, and it actually went on to win awards after we left high school and stuff. It was pretty cool. And so I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. I like telling a story. And so
did you shoot these people on the...
video, yeah. We shot high 8mm, you know.
Had you done that before? Fooled around with a camera?
No, well, yeah, because it wasn't in speech class. It was also the video side of school. Like, so that we were operating, you know, we come in the video deck at the time and do school news kind of a thing. So there was that dabbling of sorts.
Everybody did that?
No, just me and this other guy that was in speech class.
So this is yet another aspect of you, right? Another interest of yours. Because not everybody is doing this, right?
Yeah, no. And then at the time, I was really a good shot on my rifle team, and I went to Olympic training in Florida in Camp Blanding, and I missed one point to try out for 92 Barcelona, Spain.
For what?
For Olympics shooting.
Oh my goodness!
So, and I was like naturally gifted. So I, at that point, I said to myself, okay. And I was a junior that year, so next year was a senior. I said to myself, if I win first place in prone, kneeling, standing, which are three positions shooting, if I win first place in everything, I'll move forward with the rifle. And I missed, and I got second. I got first place in everything, but I missed, and I got second place in kneeling.
Oh my
and
God.
I said to myself, you know what? I'm done. So I hung up the rifle.
Oh my God!
And I never shot competition again. And because at that time I had to make a decision, either I was going to go the military path, right? And at that time, with my skill set, there was really only a skill set, go be a sniper.
Right.
And it's not like, you know, I don't know if I want to go be a sniper. You know, it's one thing to go in the military, fly jets, or do trucks, but, oh, you're such a good shot, go do be a sniper. And I was like, but I enjoy shooting cameras.
Right.
I like the theater stuff, and I get to tell people what to do, kind of, if I'm a, you know, theater, like, I get to control something, an image
yes,
of some
yeah,
sort.
Yeah.
So, and Georgia Tech offered me a scholarship to go to Georgia Tech, and I was like, but it was like a $2,000 shooting scholarship, and the school was $12,000 a year.
Ooh, not enough. No.
And I said to myself, you know, you can be competitive, you know, when you're older in life, over 40. It's not like Olympics, when, you know, at Olympics, you know, after you're 25 or you're 30.
It's over.
Yeah, but there's many competitive shooters, you know, in their 40s. So I was like, you know what? Maybe I'll come back to it. And then I went to photography school at Valencia. No, I'm sorry, I went to film school. And that was probably from the theater and the videotaping and the little thing I did with the, I think it was called STEPS. It was an acronym for something. It's like, okay, let's me pursue film. And then I went to film school and I learned.
Whoa. This is out of high school you went to film school?
Yeah. Technical degree.
2-year technical degree.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to apply or you...
No, well, Valencia Community College.
They were glad to have you.
Yeah, I mean, it was good enough. It was like going to... you know, Manatee Community College.
Yeah, right. Okay, but they had a...
film program.
Phew.
Yeah, so it was neat because it was like 92, so 94, it was kind of independent, and, you know, the guy that ran it, he made a movie, and I don't know if you remember MASH.
Of course I do.
Well, the guy who shot MASH, the director of photography, was our camera teacher.
Wow.
So he came and taught class, and I learned all the aspects of movie making. I learned about the lights and the set and what jobs people do. We all did the job. But at the end of the day, it was like too many chiefs, not enough Indians in film school. Everybody's a director. Everybody wants their own vision, and so you couldn't really break through or do anything,
right?
Because it was a very political. Oh, the student has something, and you're working on some program, and you're working with the, you know, here's which I really didn't understand at the time. I was really going to a below the line school compared to above the line. Below the line being everything below directors and producers. But then I took photo one class with like an 80-year-old professor.
In Rice Community College.
So I went to photography class, something to do. And then I started shooting for the school paper. It was back in black and white and actually laid up the paper and stuff. But our teacher never really taught us. All he told stories about when he was a journalist for Life magazine. So we would be reading our photography books, looking at Cartier Bresson and all these great photographers, and he's telling us firsthand story.
Wow.
Oh, let me tell you what he said. Oh, that photo on page 14, I was there when he took it.
Wow.
Let me tell you what he came in about. And it was like 80, he walked with a cane. But you're like, you're literally learning photography, more photojournalism from this guy. You know, from 4-1 class, 4-2 class. And then from there, I was like, wow, that's kind of cool. You know, I can make an image. And I'm in charge. You know, there's
Again.
Nobody else telling me what to do. Unlike film, where you have to collaborate, you know, if you're not the director, you have to, well, there's degrees. But the point was that I can affect my battle space with a still photography much more effective.
I got it. What's so interesting about you is that that's the thing that, I can't think of what the word is, that is similar in all of your interests, that you can decide, that nobody's telling you what to do. Do you think I'm wrong?
Well, yeah, no, I don't think so. I think, you know, I'm open to suggestions if it makes sense.
No, I understand. I'm not saying that you're rigid and
yeah,
you don't...
Yeah, I love telling people what to do.
Yeah, right.
I love
I know, I saw it. I saw it, in the, you know.
Yeah.
And people listen. They just do.
Yeah, I am the guy who, if everybody's quiet long enough, I will speak up and I will move that group to do something.
You make something happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing that is absolutely... consistent in all of your interests. So okay, so this guy, he turns you on.
Yeah, yeah. And then from there, I actually, I did the school paper for a while, and then he told me about, oh well, Daytona Beach has a great photography program. I came home with mom and dad, and I'm like, film's cool, but I think I'm really digging photography now. And it's like, it's, you know, film is at the time 24 pictures in 1 second, or tell all your story in one picture.
Wow.
You know, mm-hmm. So to me, at the time, film was sloppy. It's 24 frames a second. You know, why, you know, let's just concentrate on one frame. So I went to Daytona Beach Community College, and I proceeded to get a degree in still photography. And we went with 8x10 view cameras, 4x5s, Mamiyas, you name, from medium format, large format, and it was great. Because it was just at this time, digital was starting to come back, and Photoshop 3 or 4 was out. And I remember the first Kodak digital camera, like, took a picture, and it sucked. I was like, this sucks, this will never do anything, this is horrible. Well, we all know differently now. But it was cool, because I would go to the checkout window, I'd check out a Hasselblad, I'd check out a Mamiya,
oh my
I'd
God.
Check out a rangefinder, a Leica. And I'd be like, whoop, I'm a student. I would go and shoot these, you know, thousands and thousands of dollar cameras. And develop film black and white. And I remember just doing black and white and, you know, going in the morning and coming out at night. I had no idea what the time was, just developing black and white. And people today, they don't understand that the tools in Photoshop, they mean something. Like that little one that had the Dodge tool is actually the tool in the darkroom. And the hand that says burn, you actually use your hand to control light. Is the next. So, you know, it's funny because all those little symbols, some of the symbols in Photoshop is directly related to the darkroom.
You know what all of that stuff actually does, because you actually did it, right?
Yeah, and I think the big thing, too, in photography school that used to bother me to no end, well, you know, we get some great photographers that have great eyes, and they're creative, and they would take a photo, but they couldn't tell you why.
Why?
They couldn't tell you the mechanics of it. Like, oh, yeah, just look how great. Well, is that an F8? Or what do you mean F8, 5.6? We blew out the background. Did you do why? Because you wanted... And I was like, to me, you're responsible for everything in your image, 100%. And I would be the guy who asked all the teachers all the questions all the time. And when I see somebody had a great shot, but they didn't know how they got it, they got lucky. I'm like, there's no luck. You should, you know, well, I say that, but when you're creating an image, you should know what you want, what you go for. Obviously, there's some luck to capture the right moment. But that would just drive me crazy in class, because I guess it goes back to my, you know, being exacting and knowing what you're doing.
Well, and, so. You know, to be a good shot, you have to be exacting, don't you?
Yeah, I lost going to Barcelona Olympics by 1 millimeter.
Right.
You know, the width of the human hair was 1 point.
That's right.
So, I know all about being exact. So, so it was interesting because at the time, too, in some of my advanced class, we had one professor that did Cibachrome, which is kind of a lost art. It's printing from slides, not negatives, and contrast mask. And it was just amazing how technical he was to know all that. And then we take it all for granted, Photoshop now, HDR, and, oh, look at this tool, look at this tool. But people were kind of doing that, but old school analog, where you take a picture and you make a picture of a picture, you take a negative, put the negative in the slider to carry back the light, and you crank up the green so that all your green would come in a different tone. But now it's just selecting the Photoshop. So it was interesting to me to see that level of technique.
Well, it's so interesting that you started when you did, because you started right before the shift. So you learned everything right before, right? Musicians of a certain age are annoyed at what kids are doing now and think they're doing it. They have no idea what they're doing, you know, but the equipment does it, right?
Right.
Yeah. It's the same thing. So the other thing I'm thinking is that you're very smart. I mean, somebody might have wanted to know all this stuff or wanted to remember all this stuff or wanted to put all this stuff together, but you actually can. You actually did, right?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm a visual learner, and, you know, I kid people around me, like, I'm blessed with my eye, like, I could see light and stuff, and if to spell or to form sentences, I'm like, that's like too much work, and I want to use capitals and punctuation, and drives my writer friends crazy. But, you know, so I think, you know, when I went to that film school, and then I had a degree in film, and then I took a degree in, you know, photography at Daytona Beach Community College, and it was like almost a 3-year study, even though it's still technical. And then there was like nothing I didn't know about photography. And at the time, that was kind of still before digital, too. We still had to do film.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of still had to know what you were doing. It's not like now we look at the back of the camera, well, that didn't work out.
Yeah, right.
You know, and do multiple exposures and 4x5 and, you know, things like shine fluid, which is where everything meets, and focus plane, and, you know, stuff that you don't even know anymore. So photography school. So I went to 3 years of photography school and, you know, learned as much as I could. And about the nuances.
So are you, at this point, how old are you by this time?
Let's see, I was 24, and I was probably 22, I guess.
22, you've done all this stuff by the time you're 22.
Yeah, went to 2 degrees, yeah.
But in the meanwhile, you still, well, I'm saying, did you have an idea what you were going to do with this stuff?
You know, no.
No, that's what it sounds like.
I was like, photography, and, you know, we had some people come in for business and, you know, come out and, when I got out, I think the first thing I started doing was looking for an assistant job, and I bought a 4x5 camera and a Mamiya camera, and I was going to start doing some kind of photography work. And I remember working very early for actually Golf Course Business Review. It was called the Review back then, just doing, you know, some editorial stuff. And let me back up. There's a funny story. So, you know, I went to my 4-to-1 class in Valencia was for journalism. You know, taking the cool photos, you know, in the moment. And then so I took one day and I actually had an opportunity to be a stringer for the Orlando Sentinel. And I took some beautiful photos on the beach. A guy in a massage chair on the beach. It was really odd and out of place. And I took a photo. It was a great little feature story. But I take it back and, you know, to the editor, and I show him the photos, and she's, oh, this is great. She said, what's the story? I said, what do you mean the story? It's a great photo. It's like, yeah. Well, did you get the guy's name? Did you, you know, talk to the guy? What's going on? I was like, no, I just took the picture. No, you gotta get the guy's name. It's like I said, for every photo? I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? That's not for me. You know, I take pretty pictures. And then, you know, be a journalist, I need to control. So the big story goes, there's a conference room with executives. And there's one side has a window and it's a blind. And the blind is closed and it's very dark. As a photojournalist or as a journalist, you go into that and open up the blind and let light in, so you can make some exposures on your camera.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you leave it closed because that's part of the story?
Ah.
You see what I'm saying?
So yeah.
That was a big question. as far as telling stories go. And I was like, hell no, you control it. You control everything you can. And so you open up the blind, let the light in. And then you're just, so, you know, going back to photography school and then getting out of photography school, I remember one assignment where 17th Dog Park opened up in Sarasota.
Mm-hmm.
And all the dogs were there. And I had a friend of mine who had a couple of greyhounds and they had a fake fire hydrant. And I was like, well, let's just get the dogs lined up. Like, they take a, you know, line to go get pee. You know, we literally took the dog, lifted him, put him in the line. And I took a shot, and I called, you know, and it looked like it was editorial. Like, it went out. I was like, hell no, that never happened, but I made it happen. You know, so it's, so to me, I knew I could never be a journalist, because I would just always affect the scene.
Right, right,
the best
right,
possible
right.
outcome. In my mind, at least, telling them my side. So, I got out, and I had a 4x5 camera, and I was on Siesta Key Beach taking a photo. And the 4x5 camera is just a huge camera that has a thing that goes over your head, and one guy came up who was walking the beach, and hey, how you doing? And I met a photographer called Greg Wilson, and he still photographs today, and I became his assistant for a long time. He was an architectural photographer, because he, what he said to me, I was like, not too many people come out to the beach with a 4x5 camera. I was like, you're right. So I assisted him for a while.
So this is just happenstance, this is just luck.
Yeah, just luck, you know, I was an assistant for that, and then I decided to, I got the idea because I used to sail boats and be a sailor, and I was an Eagle Scout and Boy Scout and sail and stuff. So at the sailing squadron, at Labor Day, they had the Labor Day regatta. So, ooh, maybe I'll take some photos for them and sell them.
Mm-hmm.
I took some photos and, wow, made some money. Hey, that's great. And so I started a business called Regatta Photo. And then I had my, and at the time I was doing that, and I also was working freelance for Bob Knight Photo as a photographer who did photography graduation. So I was bouncing around as a photographer. I would be shooting marathon photography for Action Sports Photography in Atlanta. I shot, you know, Bob Knight Photo Marketing. I shot for them.
So you're making a living?
Yeah, as a photographer at this point.
And how old are you then? By like 26, 25?
Yeah, 24, 25. But, you know, I mean, I moved back home, so I was living with my mom and dad, mm-hmm. you know, kind of doing
Oh, so you were doing fine.
Yeah, so it was good. So it was good. I was doing that before. It was like, cool. But, yeah. So now I was doing that, and then I started the company called Regatta Photo, and I would shoot photos of boating events, and then that grew, and I was like, oh, let me rent a helicopter, and I'll shoot from helicopter. So I would shoot helicopter and get the pictures developed, and then this is just expanded. Like, I would call up another regatta. It's like, oh, you have a boat? Yeah, we have the, you know, the J24, you know, Nationals. How many boats are you going to have? We have 50 boats. Great, I'll be there. So I called a helicopter. The cheapest helicopter was $200 an hour. It was called R-22. It's a 2-seater, you and the pilot. And of course, you know, you ask them to do the most complicated thing, which is to shoot boats.
Right.
With the most inexperienced pilot. Because I was working on a margin.
Right? Right.
And so I bought a camera, and I remember my first digital camera was a D30 at the time, and it was 3 megapixels, which was just good enough to make an 8x10.
Jesus.
Just good enough, 3 megapixel. And I got a 100 to 400 millimeter lens. I was in business. So I took that, and I still remember, even with the film stuff too, I still have a film camera, but I would shoot. Well, before that, I was still shooting. Well, at some point, I did do the digital, but back up a little bit. So I would go to the regattas, would get the film, I'd go in a helicopter, shoot the film, take the film before Sunday, go to like an Eckerd's Drugs or whatever, get 8x10s made up of everything, come back, put them in the, and then hopefully sell.
Yeah, right.
On Sunday.
Right.
At the end of the regatta.
Right.
And I sell for $100 a pop.
Wow.
Because, you know, who else is going to get a helicopter?
Yeah, really.
And I put him in a $2 mat. So I put an 8x10 for $2 and a $2 mat and sold it for $100. I was like, yay. And about always, when I first started, half of them sold. Always half sold. So if I knew I had 50 competitors, I was going to sell 25 and make $2,100. And my, you know, I'm paying me a grand or $1,500. But along those lines, you learn too. One time I went up as far away up to Georgia on a lake to cover some huge Hobie cat. There was no wind. And they're just sitting there. It's like, oh, they still want pictures of their boats. I went up, took pictures, lost my butt. Nobody wanted it. Mm-hmm. Them floating around. They all want to be looking good sailing.
Yeah.
And then I did the next year, but once you bought a $100 photo, you don't need another
one. You don't need another one, right.
So I had to keep going and finding
Yeah, I was just going to say, this is...
Right. So I had to keep going farther and farther away from my home base, which means the cost went up.
Right.
And I work all week to work all weekend.
Right.
So there was never a break. And then finally I landed a big contract for what you could call the Kentucky Lake Poker Run. I don't know, probably mid-90s. like late 90s. And at the time I had a partner. And it was the biggest job I ever did. Two helicopters, we were doing stills and photo of a poker run, which is like power boats up in Kentucky Lake Poker Run. So at the time, there was two pilots, two helicopters I hired, and one pilot was actually a woman, and she flew C-130s in the Air Force. And I'm like, I'm a big guy, so I got to take the light girl, because I know we're in the cheapest helicopters with the four, you know, all the weight matters. And then my other friend had a newer pilot who was not supposed to be there, but he was ferrying a brand new helicopter from the factory back to the place, and he went up with them. And so we're shooting what we call Kentucky Lake Poker Run. And I'm in the air, he's in the air, and it's really the hardest thing to shoot is when you're shooting a boat. You shoot from the quarter boat, from the back quarter of a boat, like this, is easy. And then you shoot this, and that's profile. But the hardest one is here, because you're going 80 miles an hour, the boat's getting 80 miles an hour, and you can't fly the helicopter, the small helicopter, sideways at 80. So you have to kick the tail out. As soon as it kicks the tail out, you have to take the photo before the tail goes snap
back. Right. Because the plane can't stay there that long.
Exactly.
That's right.
It's, and plus, you look at the lens, and you're flying around, and you get kind of motion sickness.
I was just going to say, I'm getting dizzy.
Yeah. We do videotape, and now it's lunchtime, and all of a sudden, I look down, there's a rescue boat with the sirens on. I'm like, oh, that's cool. They probably want a photo. I'm taking photos, I'm hovering, and then I see him. I look down. That's my buddy.
Uh-oh.
In the rescue boat. And I get all mad. I'm like, what are you doing? You're supposed to be in the air.
Oh, you're kidding. You know, you didn't realize what happened.
And then he goes, like that. And we're just through aisle. We fly down, and basically, they crashed.
Oh, God.
And he got out 100 feet underwater. The pilot had a laceration, and he got him out. And luckily, he used to be a lifeguard and a rescue swimmer.
Who was?
My partner.
Your partner. Oh.
And he got out. So here I am at noon, at lunchtime. I have helicopter, $400,000 helicopters in the drink. My buddy's alive. We lost a camera and the keys to the rental car.
Oh.
And the batteries. But military, right? Go back. What's my assets? I still have a helicopter. I still have one camera. I still have battery. I can complete my mission.
Yeah.
He's alive.
Yes, right.
So I was like, we're going back up. So I tell the girl, we can go back up. We finish shooting, come back. By that time, the FAA guy is there. He's like, what are you, your aircraft in vicinity? You can't go fly. And I'm like, that's not on me. I'm a photographer. I walked away. And let the pilots work it out. And there was a big, big to-do. And the Army, the Corps of Engineers came in. And they tried to look for the helicopter, but it was in the valley, the deepest part of the lake. And it was expensive. It was operator error. And basically, what he came down was a really hot day. And he was filming Drambuie on ice. And I guess he came around, and when he pulled back the collective, it was not enough, and he went into the drink. There's no power-to-weight ratio. You got two 250-pound guys, and the R-22 helicopter is only rated for 500 pounds. You have no more.
That's it. There's no flexibility here.
There's no window of margin where I had 100 extra pounds with the ladies. So we completed the job. We got paid. Never went back there anyways. But it was quite exciting on that one. But also, at the time, I started dating my wife, and that was put the point where I needed to sell that business and start something else because it was taken away from the weekend. And also, now that I might have a wife, she might want me around, and I died in a helicopter accident. So,
I just want to say, so what you said just now is, I just want to say it again, is now I have a wife, she might want to have me around and not die in a helicopter accident. Yes, yeah. I think that's a way of explaining why you might change. So what did you do?
Well, I at that point, it was like I split the business with my partner. We literally walked in my home office. This time we were renting a place. And I was like, that's your computer, that's my computer, your camera lens, my camera. We just pointed and we split.
Right.
And then from there, I was sitting around and then I started doing some more video. I started doing some work for Blab TV, Don Grocio in town. I think he's still around. And not to say anything, but that kind of motivated me. So at that point, I was like in between things to do. And Don was looking at, because I did a commercial, and he saw it. I was like, oh, you should shoot some commercials for me. So I started shooting some local commercials with a little handy cam. And then he said, hey, why don't you think about, I need to make my station look better. Because, public access, old green stuff. It's horrible looking.
Oh, God. Yeah. And then this is your thing. This is what you do, right?
So I took it to heart. So
yeah, no kidding.
I researched it. I did a PowerPoint. I traveled to Florida, a couple of different TV stations, other local access to see what they were doing. I made a big presentation, and he was going to pay me for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I presented, I was like, you should do this new technology called green screen with virtual sets. It's easy to do. It's not that my cameras are coming the wrong way. Present the whole thing. And then, of course, there was an old guy that was running the tape deck that he trusted his opinion. Oh, that's too expensive. It never happened. I'm like, you know, technology keeps going.
Right.
You know?
That's right.
And he knocked it down. So we're not going to do that. I was like, okay, well, you know, I'm paying you like, you know, $300, whatever it was I agreed on. No, I wasn't going to pay you. Like, what? You're not going to pay me? No. I called up my partner at the time. It was my buddy named Clint. I was like, did I not hear this guy right? Is he not going to pay me? I was really mad.
Yeah.
You know? He's like, yeah, can he? So he kind of, you know.
Drinking problem.
Drinking, yeah, a little bit. So I was like, well, hell, you know what? I'm gonna start my own TV station. So at the time, there was a FCC rule, and that the cable companies had to provide public access. It wasn't publicized, but if you dig deep enough, you could find all this stuff. And as long as you had insurance, they had to give you airtime.
Wow.
It was public service, and you only had to cover the cost. So I would buy 30 minutes for $67. And resell it for $1,500. So Blab had all the channels covered because he already bought all the airtime and was doing it. So I went to Bradenton, and it was Bright House, and I started Suncoast Network TV.
Oh my.
And then I was like, man, I could do all this. So I started making shows. I started making 30-minute shows. I had paper and people coming out of woodwork. I did one called Captain Kim's Adventures, and she would take a boat, like a pontoon boat out in Cortez and like, you know, pull fish and stuff out of the water and stuff. We'd film that, and then we had a financial show for 30 minutes. People, you know, we did green screen just like the sets. I said, I bought the sets, and
right.
We did that. Then we did collector cars, which was on Blab TV too. But we put it in Bradenton, and we revamped his show. So we were going pretty strong. And then at the time, I was looking at this place, but my other place, at the studio, and he said, so I had Suncoast Network TV. And it was pretty much got on air. I remember the first show we saw it on TV from like a coffee house. I was like, yay.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was just trying to hobble this together. We had a computer that would play the shows. Like it was an MP4. I take it all for granted now, but at the time it was card because it was a little Mac Mini, first generation. And I was at the head. Digital Bright House gave me the key to the head in, which is where all the stuff came in. So he would know me, hey, and he'd give me a little rack, and I'd put my computer in the rack right there, and he'd say, you know, that's your spot, Mark. And I'd plug into their system, and come 7 o'clock at night, switches over, takes my video signal, and I was on channel 62 or 162 in Bright House.
Like, yeah, yay!
And so, but inevitably, this computer wasn't like a super awesome, it would lock up. So people would watch our shows, and the TV would stop. Like, it would stop playing. Mark, my show's not on. I'd be at dinner with the family. And like, I gotta go, honey. Like, what do you mean, I gotta go?
Right.
So I'd go all the way over to the freaking place, reboot the computer, press play.
Aye, aye, aye.
Yeah, like 25 minutes up the
road. Yeah, right, right.
And hopefully I could do it before the next show goes on.
Right.
The next customer would get mad.
Right.
And we did that, but then once they started going digital and it moved from analog and Bright House digital boxes, there was a whole transition period. My channel 62 was now like 473. It was nowhere near to be found. I was like,
right.
The right was on the wall on that. It was just hard. Like, we just repeat the shows a lot. And I also got public domain. I bought a whole bunch of Beverly Hillbillies that you could re-air. And yeah, I'm black and white, and we put that on TV as well, like the old episodes.
Yeah, right.
And at the end, so that kind of went away, and I kind of morphed that into a show called Beach Buzz. So then I went back to Sarasota, and Don Grisio dominated the late night, and then I bought 8 a.m. slot, 8 to 8:30, every single day. And the idea was to have like a hotel show, like a tourist show, like what to do, what to go. And that actually worked for a couple of years pretty well. I hired a guy. And I did 2-minute videos on places. Hi, I'm the owner, and I love doing this. So I had the Village Cafe on it. I had, you know, the Crescent Market. I had a bunch of Siesta Key businesses on it. And they would spend $300 to $400 a month with me and, you know, repeat their show. And every morning, if you wanted to see it at 8 a.m., it was called Beach Buzz TV. What's going on? I had a host. And then when this market started to kind of go south with the real estate, like the big boom, and it was hard to collect dollars. But when I looked at the dollars and cents of that kind of, as much work we put into it, you know, everything paid for itself, but there was no really and a lot of headaches for yeah. not a lot of cash out of the deal. Mm-hmm. So we finally, we just canceled the whole thing. I didn't even feel it. Like, all my life became better. Just, you know, but it wasn't like losing money, but I wasn't making money either.
No, right. And
yeah, so.
But the stress was gone.
The stress was gone. Yeah, so, and then from there, I started doing car commercials for Wild Automotive, did that. She was a great client for about 4 or 5 years. And then just, you know, word of mouth. At that time, I did enough work for this person, that person, that, oh, you go talk to Mark. Or sometimes we'd be known as the guys from Mars, with our boys from Mars.
So you, when did you start Mars?
2004.
Wow.
So, yeah, I skipped ahead. So we got a photo, we left, and then I had like in between time and did a lot of wedding videos for a bit of time. And then finally we had, I was drinking beer, watching TV, and there's the Mars rover, you know, landed on Mars. And my buddy, who's an accountant, and my wife, what should we do? Maybe we should start a big company. What do you call it? I don't know, Martian Vision? And I'm like, yeah, Martian Vision. Yeah, let's get everybody behind, everybody excited. And wife comes around, just call it Mars Vision. She always is a very smart woman. She and I married. So she goes, Mars Vision. I go, okay. So we started Mars Vision in 2004, right where Suncoast Network TV happened. And that's, so Suncoast Network TV was developed by Mars Vision Productions. And I moved into my place over here. So we started doing the shows. And before we went to Beach Buzz TV, I was, you know, confident that we were going to do good because Collector Cars said, I'll do 3 years, you know, $75,000, 3 year contract. You do my shows once a week, 4 shows a month. I was like, you got it.
Yeah, really?
So I signed the lease for $4,000 a month. Going to make shows. 12 weeks later, I'm out of money. Now I can't do it. I signed the lease like 2 months earlier.
Oh, my God.
4 years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I even
This is the story of your life.
Yeah, this is it. This is it. Yeah. Even in the lease, I wrote in a part where I could have a 99-foot flagpole or a 100-foot flagpole so I could send signals to Comcast to go live.
Uh-huh.
And that's because right before the internet was starting to really hit at 2 minutes mm-hmm. apiece. I mean, that never happened because in that 4 years since, you know, internet happened. And I actually remember my friend talking about Netflix doing streaming, Netflix first streaming. I said the same stupid thing again. That's never going to work. Look how small it is. Now look at it, right?
Right, right.
I need to rethink that every time I say that. And you're like, well, maybe not. But so that happened. And then just one thing led to the other. And I was lucky enough to, you know, I've done so many videos over the edge. But I've never really, I used to do, you know, everybody goes to film school, photography school to do narrative work.
Right.
You know, and so I missed the boat. And I don't say I'm gonna miss the boat. I didn't really want to go to California or go to New York.
Right.
I have like, there's attitudes there. I didn't want to deal with.
Well, and that gets in the way of your, you don't start in New York or L.A. controlling the situation.
No.
You know,
yeah,
you have to let someone else control it for a long time,
yeah.
Right, before
yeah, exactly.
before you get an opportunity to control it. So that would probably was a good choice
yes.
on your
yes.
part. That in this environment you just kept choosing things to do that you could control.
That's a good point. Yeah.
You know? And so now you're doing the Well, you tell me. What are you doing?
Well, so that was 04, and then, you know, Beach Buzz went 06, 07, 08, got changed, you know, doing car commercials. And now, throughout that, I did some 48-hour grill film festivals, which is basically, you know, you shoot and tell a story in 48 hours. You know, plays pretty well that, and that cut my teeth as far as, you know, doing some very stressful narrative and, you know, control and get it done. And then now I'm kind of like, in a way, where I help people out. For instance, before Catherine showed up with her project, there was a project I did a couple years ago, and a guy comes to my studio and says, Mark, I have a shoot day November 22nd, I have 20 people in my cast, I have a location, I have everything, but I did this backwards, I have no production company, I have no director, but I'm ready to go. I'm like, you're ready to go, you got all that in place. I'm like,
well,
okay, I'll do it. So, you know, and so that's kind of like how I've, you know, helped people out, and he's Planet Strange, and he's a great writer and stuff, and I'm sure his stuff will go eventually. And then, you know, Catherine Parks, I mean, the story there. So, you know, fast forward, that's been my life, Mars Vision. I love telling real estate videos. I do real estate. I do corporate commercials. I love trade show videos, ones I can have fun with, you know, and do over the top tests and stuff. And there's a lot of those examples over the years I've did. But to get back to, you know, Catherine Parks, she went to Sarasota Film Festival. She saw some films. It sucks. I can write these stories. This is better than And so she saw it. I was like, you know what? It's time for her to grow, she said. And so she wrote the story, and I read the story. I was like, yeah. And then she goes, Mark, you want to direct it? I'll produce it. You do everything. I got to show up. That's a lot of work, Catherine. You want to do that? Are you sure? I said, yeah. I just need to, yeah. I was like, okay. I'm in. And so I'm in.
So where are you now in post-production, right?
Post-production right now. We've got all the major days, you know, shot. There's probably a couple pickup shots to be seen, to be done. But now.
And then what's the plan for it?
To edit it very soon. So I don't want to put any deadlines out there because, you know, we want it. It'll be done when it's done. Mm-hmm. But we are motivated to get it done.
So. Yeah, but after you get it done.
You know, submit it to some festivals, you know. I think at the end of the day, if I can look at it on the big screen with all the cast and crew and I can laugh at the parts I think
that are funny,
laugh
right?
At, mm-hmm. I'll say good day.
Yeah.
For me. So, you know, and who knows where we'll go from that or at. I mean, you know, this town, you know, they want production and I've been here for 10 years and I've seen, you know, people come and go, Sanborn Studios, and production has no soul. It has no soul. They're gonna go where the money is. The big Hollywood people and they're gonna go where they can get a money to put their back. So I'm thankful for this incentives for Sarasota County. But it's not as big as the state incentives with the county incentives. But, you know.
Well, and so far, you have been able to design a life in which you are in control of who you are and what you do.
Yeah, that's interesting how you put that. And yeah, so I'm a success story because I went to film school, photography school, and I'm doing photography and film. And it's so funny. I like doing film now more than photography because now I find photography boring.
Yeah, sure. Because after you've touched, after you've shot the shot, there's nothing.
Yeah.
But with film, you are ongoingly telling everybody what to do. The light goes here, the camera goes here, the person goes here. No, not like that. Do it like this.
There's infinite
control.
Decisions.
That's right. It's infinite. It's perfect. It is your milieu. It is your environment. It's your water if you were a fish, right?
Yeah. So I do like it, but I think I don't like the labor of it, you know?
What do you mean? The physical labor?
The physical, yeah. You know, like just moving the cameras, getting things ready. I mean, if you know, my perfect dream would be a walk-on
An
director,
assistant.
You know, I just walk on. Okay,
right.
Here's
no,
the story.
You just need an assistant to move all that
stuff,
I do. Right?
Yeah, I need
to.
Right. Being low budget and cost conscious, I'm not quite there
You're not
yet.
Quite there yet, but you have made the move every single time. It's astonishing. Okay, I have one more question to ask. Most of the people that I interview have done one thing pretty much all their life. They've been musicians, or they've been artists, or they've been writers. And maybe they've had to do other things in between or stuff, but there's a through line, right, to what they do. For you, the through line seems to be your passionate need to be in charge, to create it so that it fits your vision. But the other through line seems to be visual. Even the shooting is visual. It's eye-hand coordination, right? Right. So the question is, having spent a life continually changing the things that didn't work, moving sort of unerringly from one thing to another, all of which seem to have in common this passion for vision, this passion for creating something visual, right? And being the person who designs it and controls it and says it's done now, right?
Yeah.
What would you say about that life, about what that's like, about what that means for you or to you?
You know, it's a curse and a blessing.
Ah, yes, I believe you. Tell me.
I see bad video and it's like wrenches my soul, like bad lighting. And it's like, you know, even on my worst day, I can't shoot that bad. You know?
Yeah.
And so sometimes I need to let it go. Like, and that's probably my curse being, look at me, I'm still one guy.
Yeah.
Because it's hard for me to let it go. I can't, you know, I don't do widgets here. You know, people come to Mars Vision because they don't know how to get it done, or they have some project that's kind of out there or something that they, you know, they need that level. Because
they need help.
They need help. I mean, I shot 2 years ago, I shot a grizzly bear on a golf course. A 700-pound grizzly bear for the PGA, and I said to the guy, you know, it was a golf course, and he had a bronze bear, and they were doing the challenge. It's a bear hole, is what they called it. And so they had a theme about it. And I was like, I said, dude, you know, there we are. After we do a lifestyle video, just, you know, happy smiley faces for no good reason at all, having good times with tennis and drinking wine by the bar, whatever. I've done a million of those, right? It's like, why don't you get a bear? I said, why don't you get a bear on a golf course and have a bear with your bronze beard. You could do that. I was like, sure, you could do that at the time. I'm like, I say yes. And I figure it out. You know, so, and then that kind of snowballed, and then it's like, I didn't think she would do it. She called me again. I was like, really? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, you really want to do it? I'm like, yeah. So I call, I'll go over here, because I thought, you know, the Big Cat Habitat, I get those bears.
Yeah.
It's just money.
You right. Throw no, money that's at right. It, that's know, right. Right. They got it. Somebody knows how to bring a bear.
Right. So, right. And then they didn't really respond, but then I called, and I looked at the bear, and I called some guy in Montana. Like, well, that's too far for me, but there's a guy in Naples who has a couple of bears. Like, great. His name is Dirk or something, and he's got, you know, Tonk, the freaking grizzly bear. I was like, hell yeah. So I was like, how much for the bear? He's like, he goes, $6,000. I go, okay, sweet. So at PJ, I was like, 25 G's. All right, let's go. All right, somewhere in there, I'll make some profit, and I'll spend it all with cat, with crew and cast. And then I had to get insurance, and I had to get a $5 million rider. I'm like, really? How really? Much a bear is, you know, how many people can a bear eat? $5 million. I mean, come on. $1 million? I mean, bite one person, kill one before it gets taken down? I don't need, like, $10 million for, like, a rampage all over the place. But it was pretty exciting. That's a whole other story. But, you know, you're right. Like, to be in control and to do that. And then we did a beautiful 2 years ago with, I did a James Bond themed house video. That was off the chain.
All right, so I'm interested to hear you talk about this thing of the curse and the blessing, because what it sounds like you're saying is that you're a perfectionist, and that you have a level, a standard that that you are bound and determined to meet for yourself, and that that helps to make you as good at what you do as you are, but it also makes seeing other people not live up to a standard painful to observe. Did I get that wrong?
Yeah, like I've seen some websites and some people out there, even like video companies that put, you know, samples out there, and like the highlights are blown out, and like not everybody, but that just pains me. Like, did you not know that that was bad? You know, and the same thing is like, it does slow me down a little bit, but you know, you can shoot good video on any budget. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, nobody says you have to point the camera over here. You know, if you don't have the budget, don't shoot it. Just rearrange it. You know, you'd be surprised. You point the camera a little bit differently, it looks fine. And it's funny, I have an example of an interview setup. You know, you affect your situation, you affect your environment. And the videographer couldn't move the table. He didn't want to move the table. But if you move the table, you could have lit the person better and backed out the door. And now you have what I would think in my world, a beautiful interview setup compared to his. So, you know, I think for that, because I do have the photography background, and so I'm really cross-versed, and now that cameras can do both, like I've been doing both for 20 years, so it doesn't even affect me. Like video guys can't, you know, still guys, they don't know how video works, or video guys don't know how strobe works. Man, I've forgotten more than those guys will ever know.
Yes.
Because I grew up old school. I grew up, and now even the people teaching photography is a revelation. Like, 20 years ago, you can't leave a light stand in the shop because they, you know, it was analog. So the older, they don't do that. But now you can put light stands all you want because in Photoshop you can
take them out.
Right. So why are you
not doing that?
You know
oh
what I'm saying?
My
so,
God.
So, and then I kind of mastered that. I had like 2 years ago, I had like a photography enlightenment. I did a lot of HDR composite work. And if you were on my Mars Vision Productions website, you go to photography, you could see all those photos I took. And some of those are just one scene. And I shoot it, and then I light every little thing individually, then I put it all back together.
Oh, my God.
And so I mastered that. Like, I don't say I mastered it, but I'm over it. Like, I did it. I proved to myself I could do it. Even sunset photo, like, years ago, I shot the most beautiful sunset on Siesta Key Beach. I never shot a sunset again. You know, went out to physically. That's when I shot sunset, but to actually go on assignment, I'm going to sit up. Because I got it.
You got it, right. You don't have to do it again.
So, you know, that's interesting. So, you know, the curse and the blessing being that, people, you know, I always want to strive for the best, you know, in my lighting and story, as what I could do for the budget. And then, of course, being like, if I ever want to grow this company, I got to start making widgets. I got to say, well, here's a testimonial video, here's this video, I can hire somebody, and they can go out and do that, and, you know, because at the end of the day, it's me.
Dang, me. Right.
You know, it's me and my vision, and what I think Mars Vision should be for somebody else. But,
that's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Mark Palmer. God.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. When Mark says it's a blessing and a curse, he is speaking, I think, for all
people who really know who they are, who are deeply committed to who they need to be in the world and how they need to accomplish it. And I think it's not uncommon for people who are so deeply connected to their inner self to be perfectionistic. And perfection, as Mark describes it, is a blessing and a curse. It is, as I said, the mission of the Lin Show to say that it is possible to know who you really are and to honor that completely. And so if you have questions about that and you want to talk to me, please do go up on my website, thelinshow.com. As always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use. Something that inspired you, perhaps, to ask yourself, are you deeply aware of who you are and committed to that? Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang.